though it's considered to be a Rabbanan, the Rishalmi does link it to a pasuk, to the Davul Lashonus of Geula, pasuk in Parshas Vayera, Boseisi, Vitzalti, Vigalti, Vilakati. And we pose a question, which is similar to a question Rishka Rav asked. We formulated it a drop differently, but it's basically in line with the Rishka Rav's presentation of the issue, of whether Dalet Kosa should be perceived as a chiyuv of drinking, that Chazal wanted us to drink on Pesach because it manifests cheres, and four is because of the Dalet Lashonus of Geula. We mentioned the summary shown and asked why not four pieces of meat. We mentioned the idea that some other Mephoreshim have that wine is transformative, and the Ramban notes the four Lashonos represent four stages of Geula, so we want to transform from one stage to the other. So perhaps that's what's going on. It's a mitzvah of drinking times four. Alternatively, maybe it's not a mitzvah of drinking, and the four represents four mitzvahs that we have Pesach night that are speech-oriented. Let's say for now they are Kiddush, Haggadah, Benching, and Hallel. And that perhaps, just like all year round, we do some of these things a la coast, or sometimes we do. So Chazal insisted specifically that Pesach night we do them a la coast, because that represents cheres. And if that's the case, so then that means it's really a tzura of a bracha al hakos. And we supported this point a little bit by noting the Gemara in Brachos that says that in terms of Havdalah, so Havdalah, the whole history was, it was originally al hakos, and then when the Jews couldn't afford wine anymore, so then they allowed them just to make it in tefillah, and then Chazru v'Hashiru, when they became richer again, so then they reinstalled Havdalah al hakos, which conveys this point, that making a bracha al hakos connotes being well off, and perhaps that's in keeping with the theme of the Seder in terms of the Sevim and the like. So we talked about that question. Basically, is the mitzvah a mitzvah of drinking? Or is it a mitzvah of a bracha al hakos? We mentioned a few possible nafkaminas. We talked about the question of whether you can do talit kosos through shamea ka'oneh. That if you believe it's a mitzvah of drinking, so then shamea ka'oneh doesn't have any role. Shamea ka'oneh is only by speech-oriented mitzvahs. But if it's a mitzvah of making a bracha al hakos, so then just like Kiddush is recited al hakos, and yet people can listen to the bracha and biyotzei from shamea ka'oneh, so too, maybe all the Seder night mitzvahs have the same status. So does anyone maintain that you can do shamea ka'oneh for the four kosos? So the Rambam does not say this, but Tosfos might say this. So it could be a machlokus Tosfos and the Rambam. We discussed a little bit that it's not really clear that Tosfos really thinks this halacha. The conclusion of Tosfos kind of backs away from it. But besides that, we mentioned an approach to Tosfos, that Tosfos wasn't really saying that the whole goal of Dalet Kosos can be fulfilled through Shamei Ka'oneh, but Tosfos was addressing the Mishnah. The Mishnah says that even somebody who has to take from Staka should take Dalet Kosos, and apparently this is the source for the idea that Pursumei Nisa is a huge priority and we'll do whatever we can to do Pursumei Nisa. So Tosfos was maybe just asking, all right, so for Pursumei Nisa, let's have one set per household. That we have, just like we have Kiddush, we can do Dalet Kosos that way also. But it could be that Tosfos would agree that as far as the mitzvah of Dalet Kosos is concerned, you really have to have your own set. It's just that for the purposes of Pursumei Nisa, which the Mishnah says you have to even go begging for, so that Tosfos says, okay, you have to, you can suffice maybe with one set. So that was one issue. Another issue was also the question of how much do you have to drink? That if it's a mitzvah of drinking a kos, so then it should be some halachic definition of a kos, whether it's a revius, like some Rishonim maintain, or rov revius. Since we apply the principle of rubo kulosh, it could be rov revius, or rov kos that holds at least a revius. But some halachic definition of what a kos is. While Tosfos again maintains that it could follow Kiddush, and the Kiddush, you just taste a mali lugma, but it's really a halacha in tasting from the kosher bracha, rather than a halacha of drinking, so that would apply to Dalet Kosos as well. We also talked about the question of what happens if you forget to say Yalav Yavo in benching. It was a suffix one of the contemporary Achronim had. So if you have to then bench again, because you forgot Yalav Yavo, so then should you have to bench again al hakos? Do we say that the requirement is you do all these mitzvahs al hakos, or is it that you have a mitzvah to drink four kosos, and that you're doing anyway? We discussed also the Gemara has a statement that you can't have it all in one shot, and there were two different views, and we've shown them what that means. According to the Rashi, you pour them all into one big novelty glass. And according to Rashbam, that wouldn't even be what to talk about, because there's no upper limit to what a kos is. So that would be one kos according to everybody. So according to the Rashbam, the Havamina was that you have four cups, but not in the right place in the Haggadah. So it just reflects these two possibilities as well, that Rashi apparently is concerned about keeping four for four cups, and the Rashbam is concerned about keeping them in the right place because it's a din of a bracha al hakos. And then we talked also about the role of cheres, the fact that cheres is a specific component to this mitzvah, and that reflects itself a few ways. One of the major ways, halacha l'maaseh, is the question of using grape juice. And we saw there's two mutually exclusive approaches, that Moshe Feinstein was quoted by his son, David Feinstein, as saying that you can't use grape juice, it has to be intoxicating because of cheres. And the Rav was quoted as saying the opposite, that if you don't like grape, if you don't like wine, then you can't use wine, because what cheres is there in drinking something that you hate? So therefore you should use grape juice. And indeed, the Chazon Ish and the Shabbat Rav use grape juice themselves. And then we mentioned that it does seem like they have a little bit of a proof against this from the Shulchan Aruch that says you have to drink dalak kosos even if it gives you a headache, even if it makes you not feel well. And the Yerushalmi that talked about somebody who drank dalak kosos and had a headache from Pesach till Shavuos. So that's not necessarily a problem, because in the time of the Gemara and the Shulchan Aruch they didn't have grape juice year round. But nowadays they have grape juice, so maybe that would have been an acceptable option. Do you have a question about that?
So when people mix, is there like a specific amount, like a minimum? If you just like pour in a tiny bit?
Like tiny bit of grape juice or water?
If you have majority grape juice, you pour in like very little bit of wine, like technically if you drink enough of that, it will be intoxicating.
Right, so that's what I assume. I assume that even according to your emotional view, if you mix it in some token amount of wine, it's still going to be intoxicating. That's probably a good answer to those who want to be mafia for that. According to the Rav, you're not going to have a problem anyway.
There's no
minimum amount of wine. I'm not sure if he would require minimum amount of, because it's the mara is going to look the same either way. So if it's just a question that it should be intoxicating, I don't know if there's a percentage by which it has to be intoxicating. So we talked about also issues of whether you can use Shemitah wine. It's a suffix in Yerushalmi, which some assume is also connected to this question of, is it cheres if you can't use use it without any restrictions. And then we talked about also that it's important just to know for general knowledge about the comment of the Ran here, where the Ran talks about the two opinions in the Gemara, both in the name of Rav Nachman, about what needs Haseba. Only two kosos need Haseba, but we're not sure if it's the first set or the second set. And the Ran says we have to be Machmir and assume all four need Haseba. So I, but it's into Rabbanan, something to Rabbanan Lakula. So the Ran says, first of all, he thinks it's a milsav less bay tircha, it's not a big pain, so you might as well do it. Depends who you ask about that point. But also, he says, Yisod, that you can't go to Kula here, because what does the Kula mean? So either it means go the Kula on both sides and eliminate this din completely. He says that never be an appropriate application of something to Rabbanan Lakula. So then it would mean picking one set, but neither set has any logic why it should be one set over the other, so it's not a rational kula, so that wouldn't make sense either, so you end up having to be machmir on both. So that's important to know, because it comes up in a lot of other areas of halacha this run. And then we just mentioned, to kind of end off that topic, that it sounds like we're saying that if you believe it's about the mitzvahs of the Seder night, so then it's not connected to the four lashonos of geula. However, we mentioned Meshech Chachma, who did homiletically connect the two, and he said that there is a parallelism between the Baal Lashon HaSkul and the Mitzvahs of the Seder, and without going into the details, it's basically they're all about meeting God halfway, about partaking in the Gula. So God, we want Him to sanctify us, so we sanctify, we want Him to take us out, so we have to take ourselves out, we sanctify ourselves with Kiddush. We want God to protect us, we insult even people who want to hurt us, so we want to make sure we don't hurt each other, we don't fight each other over food, thinking we don't have enough. But we bench and we advertise that we do have enough, et cetera, et cetera. We make this point that we are satisfied and happy, we don't have to fight each other. So this idea of meeting the Kodesh Baruch Hu halfway in terms of the Geula, so that could also represent why there's a fifth cup, an optional fifth cup that the Gemara talks about, to Shiloh whether or not this relates to the Kosher Elio. But if there's a fifth cup, so then we presumably need a fifth Lashon of Geula. We mentioned the Raibid, who said that it's Vahotseisi, who says that it's Vehvesi, excuse me. But we then mentioned the Netziv, who said it's actually Vidatem, Kenya Shem Elokeichem, you shall know that I am God who took you out of Mitzrayim. So it's really something we have to do. We have to correspond by understanding about God. So that's perhaps why it's optional, because not everyone reaches that level through actually fulfilling this idea of meeting Him halfway. And I think that was most of what we said about that topic. Any questions about that? Any issues? Any perspectives? Okay. So Mechiras Chametz, again, we spoke about that for a long time, but we're not going to be able to go over everything. We'll just kind of make some of the basic points that we tried to say about that. That we talked about Mechiras Chametz as a fascinating development and a controversial development about whether or not it's considered to be an adequate fulfillment of Tashbisu, or if at all fulfillment of Tashbisu, but is it at least a way of abstaining from Bayra Bali Matze? You're not considered to be in violation of owning Chametz on Pesach. And how there were those who objected to it, who saw it as some type of a harama. So we discussed the question, first of all, of whether it's based in the Talmud or not. So there are, say, three ways in which it's kind of hinted at in different places in the Gemara or in Chas overall, but none of them fully describe what we do. So in the context of a Bechor, the Gemara in the Mishnah, the beginning of Bechorah, talks about selling an animal that's about to give birth to a firstborn, but that's because, therefore, when you enter into partnership with a non-Jew, that will exempt it from Kedushas Bechor, but that's because you're really stuck otherwise. There's no acceptable way to deal with that situation because you can't do anything with Kedushas Bechor, so you'll just be up a creek. So it makes sense to avoid the situation. But that doesn't necessarily have to extend to a situation like this where you don't have the same type of challenge. The Mishnah does talk about fulfilling Tashbisu, perhaps by selling the Chametz to a non-Jew, but that's in a situation where you're really going to get rid of it forever. You're not planning on getting it back. So that was, even that, the Beis Shammai felt that you had to even still make sure that it would be consumed before Pesach, even by the non-Jew, so we don't follow that. We follow Beis Hillel, but as long as you sell it before Pesach, you're fine. But again, that still doesn't rise to what we're talking about, where we keep it in our house and we take it back after Pesach. So that is the closest, is the Tosefta. The Tosefta talks about somebody who's stuck on a boat, and Pesach is approaching, so he can sell his, or either sell or give his chametz to a co-traveler, non-Jewish, and reobtain it from him after Pesach. So that is very close to what we do, but there are major differences. First of all, that Tosefta talks about what sounds like a one-time thing, Shas Hatzchak, and not everybody doing it regularly as part of their planned schedule. That was a major deviation. So there were those who felt that there was a harama involved, that this was some type of an evasion. We emphasize that we have to, whether you object to it or not, we have to see it in proper context. So first of all, in terms of it being an evasion, we mentioned the joke, feel free to write this if you want, about somebody who pointed out that even though contemporary rabbis have prohibited smoking, so where the Orthodox Jews are not worried because they'll just sell their lungs to a non-Jew. So we assume that does not work. So why does that not work? Where do we draw the line where these things work and where it doesn't work? So we understand that there are some different applications and there are different situations. In the case here, so whether or not you consider this to be an evasion, we emphasize that first of all, it's different than other things because this is not about doing the opposite of what the Torah is asking. This is an alternate route. So sometimes when the Gemara talks about a haram, it says, here's a situation where let's say you should be chayiv in trumas and maisris, and you do something to get out of it. So you won't be chayiv in trumas and maisris. So here, it's not like you're trying to do the opposite of what the Torah says. The Torah says, don't own it, and the question is, does this rise to the level of successful non-ownership? So that's where there is a debate. And we contrasted it with hetzer mechira, which I emphasized is not to put down hetzer mechira. Hetzer mechira is very, very controversial, the idea of selling land in Israel for Shemitah purposes, But it does have the backing, it did have the backing of many great gedolim, and we're not trying to put it down. But just for illustration purposes, it is useful to see how mechiras chametz is less problematic, how it's less questionable. So we mentioned some examples. First of all, just what we just said just now, is that this was about selling land for Shemitah, is the Torah says not to work the land, and you're going to sell it so that you can work it. Here, it's not going that far in the opposite direction. The Torah says don't own chametz, so you're selling it, you're considering that a non-ownership, maybe it works, maybe it doesn't, but it's not going in the opposite direction. But some other key differences, besides the fact that Hetem Mechira has a whole other issue, that maybe there's an Isser involved in selling land in the first place, that's a whole separate point, but just that issue aside, so there are other questions that are raised in terms of how serious the sale is. Because, first of all, when you sell your chametz, so let's assume you're a normal balabas and you don't own a supermarket chain, so then you're not involved with your chametz at all over Pesach. It's locked away. But the land that's sold in Shemitah is being worked during Shemitah. There is a connection being maintained to it. That's the whole reason they do it in the first place. That's a big difference. Another big difference is in terms of the seriousness of the sale, that if the purchaser of the chametz would come to you on Pesach and say, listen, I've decided I want to keep the chametz and I'll write you out a check for the value of the chametz. So presumably you'd be okay with that. Why not? If he's paying you the value, so presumably that would be okay. But if the Arab who buys the land of Israel says, okay, I'm willing to write you out a check and I'm going to keep the land forever, hopefully we would not be okay with that. So that's a pretty big difference in terms of seriousness. So there are a number of differences that are mostly in Mechiras Chametz's favor. So as controversial as Mechiras Chametz is, it's not as controversial as other things, and there are reasons why that is true. One factor that goes in the other direction that makes Mechiras Chametz a little bit of a harder sell than Hetem Mechira is the fact that Hetem Mechira is premised on the assumption that Shemitah nowadays is Drabanan, and Mechiras Chametz, presumably, we are trying to deal with an Nesir Daraisa of Balira Balimatze. So that's one factor that goes in the other direction, but that itself was a whole discussion. That we mentioned the position of the Bechor Ashur, that the Bechor Ashur says, Taka, the whole thing is a game. And it doesn't work for Doraisas. It doesn't work if it was really a Doraisa involved. Aye, but it is a Doraisa, by Rabbi Matze. So he says, no, the Gemara says that Bedikas Chametz is only the Rabbana, because since you're Mavatel, your Chametz, you disconnect yourself from any relationship to it. So on a Torah level, that's effective. That means you are not really connected to your chametz, so it's only this a drabbanan after that point. So says the Bechor Ashur, that's why selling the chametz is effective. It's a little bit of a game, but it's only dealing with an issa drabbanan, so it works. But many, many objected to that approach, because they said, that's not true. That it's not that you're dealing with an issa drabbanan, because the chametz you're mevatel and the chametz you sell are two different sets of chametz. It's not the same chametz. So how could you argue that that's the case? It's impossible to sell stuff that you've disconnected yourself from, and it's impossible to disconnect yourself from something you're doing business with. It doesn't make sense. So normally you'd assume that the chametz you're mevatel is the chametz that may have been left under your couch and that you really hope to never see again. And the chametz you're selling is a different set of chametz. So to say it's a drabbanan is a harder argument to make. And you'd really have to get behind it and assume that it's a daraisa if you want to rely on it. So many did have a kapedah not to rely on it for actual chametz gomer. They only rely on it for secondary types of chametz. That's one approach. And we talked about a little bit about that. I'm just trying to figure out which topics we should highlight in the interest of time. So we also talked about the whole evolution of this, how it went from the stage of one person doing it occasionally to his neighbor, or his co-traveler on the boat, to this mass communal thing. So that the Tosefta does have a language, ubilvad shelo yarim, that you shouldn't use it as an evasion. So some Rishonim takasei, we don't follow these Rishonim, but some Rishonim say that it means you can only do it if it's a one-time thing, but if you're doing it every year, so then that's going to be a problem. That's what the Tosefta is saying not to do. Again, this is not the dominant view in Rishonim, but others assume that it means that it has to be an actual gift. You have to really give it over. Maybe not to Amanas. Some would say it's there to exclude Matan Amanas the Hachzir. That's one thing if you buy it back afterwards, or if he gives it back to you afterwards, but you can't make it conditional that he has to give it back to you. And even though theoretically that should work also, it could be that's part of the whole Chumrah here, so to speak. Others suggest that it means you have to actually take it out of your house. that we don't do either today. That's also something that has adjusted. So that already on the side of the page of the Shulchan Aruch and the Bach and the Taz, they explain that since we do lease out the areas where the chametz is, that's what justifies our not actually taking it out of the house. So another stage of the whole evolution here was the question of the fact that it morphed from being one individual doing it to individuals doing it on a one-by-one basis to one representative of the whole community doing it. That was a controversial development also, but it makes sense because since it's very complicated, so it's hard for everyone to get it right, and it's very possible to make a mistake, while if you have one person who's hopefully knowledgeable do it, so then you're less likely to have mistakes. And nowadays it's the rabbi, it wasn't always the rabbi, but it makes more sense for it to be whoever understands best how to carry this off without messing it up, because it's very possible to mess it up. We mentioned that among the ways to mess it up, there's many ways to mess it up. You could make a bad kinyan, that's why we try to have redundancy. We try to have as many kinyanim as possible. I remember before Pesach, Rabbi Willig, when he was going through we all go to do the mechira together in Riverdale with Rabbi Willig, and he was explaining the whole process, and he talked about the redundancy. So he called it a belt with suspenders. And then I noticed that the individual purchasing the chametz, he got up at the end, so Taka was wearing a belt and suspenders, so it was symbolic. But in any event, so this idea, we try to have as many different transactions as possible, just in case one of them doesn't work. But also, a major disastrous mistake to make is, since he doesn't pay for everything up front, and he pays just a very token amount to the Kinyan Kesef, and the entire value is a chov that he has to pay after Pesach, and so what will generally happen is he's not going to want to pay, so we'll say, okay, if you don't want to pay the 99.9% you haven't paid yet, then we'll let you not pay if you give back the chametz. That's how we end up getting it back. But it's crucial, crucial, crucial that not be conditional, that, okay, if you don't pay, it turns out it was never said in the first place. That's an example of a terrible mistake to make, because that undoes the whole thing, and then it means it was never sold, and then it was all in Jewish possession over the course of Pesach. Hi.
How many of the kinyanim does the non-Jew have to completely understand?
Well, presumably he should understand at least the whole, certainly has to understand what's going on. It doesn't even understand. You know, if you understand that this is for the purpose of effecting a transaction between me and you. So if you mean understand how it works, so then most of us don't understand that. You know, and it's a very complicated area of halacha. So I don't think it would help in terms of, like, let's say, the Kenyan suitors say, oh, by the way, pick up this penknife, and him not understand that it's a part of the Kenyan. You know, the point is that everything that we're doing...
But does he know how much he owns now, how much he'll have to pay later?
Oh, so that, that basic idea is part of the process. In terms of breaking it down to absolute numbers, possibly not. The idea that we assess the value and that we give all the locations and the like, so that is mostly because it makes sense that a kinyan is only going to take place when somebody knows what they're buying. But we mentioned that there is also the rabbi's nightmare if the rabbi loses the shtaros, so then, especially depending on how wealthy his congregation is, he could be in massive trouble, you think. But there is a tzad l'hakel there also, because even though ideally the purchase will be on something very specific, but theoretically there is a viability for a grab bag purchase, or for what's behind door number two, that even though most people would not purchase something that they don't know what it is, but the concept does exist, you can purchase a davar sheino masuyim. So if it happens, it's probably still a viable kinyan. So I've suggested recently that give the shtaros over to the purchaser and say, and if there are any shtaros that were given that are for some reason not in here, so would you intend to buy those as well? And he agrees he intends to buy those as well. I think that's valid.
You have to hold on to the shtaros.
So he does pick up the shtaros as part of the Kenyan Hagbah, but again, there's a lot of redundancy in the Kenyanim, so hopefully overall it works anyway. So what if the Kenyan taco was bad? What if it didn't work? So then does that presumably creates a situation where the chametz is now aser b'hanaz, chametz shavu leva Pesach. So that's probably true, but there are, let's say, two tzadim l'hakel. One is that there are those who say that since the whole thing is an onesh, it's a knas, so that maybe if the person was an onesh, there is a tzad l'hakel, let's say, under some circumstances. Also, there is a masas binyamin, which was quoted, that maybe there is a tzad to say that if somebody tried to make a kinyan and failed and made some mistake in the kinyan, but thought he was doing a kinyan, that maybe that's also effective as a form of bittul. Because the whole idea of bittul chametz, it's an interesting discussion. The Ran explains, why does bittul work? Right, bittul, some think bittul is a form of hefker, but hefker really should be a more formal process, and hefker should be in front of three, and you should take it outside of your house. So how does it work to create bittul? So the Ran explains that really, you don't own chametz on Pesach. It's impossible to own chametz on Pesach. Chametz is also bahana. So that's what the Gemara says, that chametz is one of two things, she'eino b'rishuso shel adam, that a person really does not own. But asana kasuv ki'ilu hein b'rishuso, the Torah basically gets you in trouble by considering it as if you own it. And we gave the comparison. It's like intermarriage. You should say, how could there be an issue of intermarriage? It's impossible to violate it, because if the Torah doesn't recognize the marriage between a Jew and a non-Jew, so then you can't violate the system. So clearly the issur is to act darachasnus, to act in a way of marriage with somebody who's a non-Jew, even though the marriage is not recognized by halacha. So too, really the ownership of chametz is probably not recognized by halacha either, and yet the ownership, the issur, is to act with ownership towards chametz, even though the halacha doesn't recognize it in the first place. So if that's the case, it's kind of a weak ownership to begin with. So therefore, bittul, which is a lower process than hefker, bittul works because it's just a way of declaring that you don't want to have connection to the chametz, so therefore this artificial ownership doesn't kick in for you. It's not something that attaches to you. So you could make an argument that if somebody tries to sell it, and it turns out the sale was bad, that has the same effect as bittul. It was a declaration that he thought he was getting rid of it, so it's like he threw it out the window and he didn't realize the window was closed, so it bounced back into the house. But essentially he thought he was getting rid of it. So there are those who are willing to consider that as a possible kula as well. So anyway, this all gets to the question of why, since it's a complicated thing to do, so we're better off having a qualified person do a sale on behalf of everyone. So that kind of morphed into what we have today, where the rabbi does it on behalf of everyone. But even within that, there were two models. One model was that the rabbi would purchase it from everyone, or whoever was to purchase it from everyone and then sell it. So that has major drawbacks to it, because it's very possible that he will succeed in buying it, then he won't succeed in transferring it to the non-Jewish purchaser. So he'll end up, as mentioned, this is kind of a Christian idea, he'll end up picking up the sins of the whole community. So this one person, the rabbi, whoever it is, will have the chametz of the whole city, but it'll still be chametz shavah v'pesach, and he'll be the one who had the chametz the whole time. That's not so good. So the way we tend to do it today, more commonly, is that the rabbi is not the purchaser ever, but he is the agent, that he is given the authority to sell on behalf of the owners of the chametz, and that's why it doesn't really need a formal process. So even though when we visit the rabbi and make the arrangements, so he tells you to lift up something like that, but that's not an actual kinyan, and the Rambam writes in a different context, it's not really necessary, that this can be authorized without a kinyan, and presumably over the internet or over the phone, as many people do today as well. But we'd like it to be a more formal process, so we have some type of a physical act, but really it doesn't require an actual kinyan. You just appoint the rabbi to act on your behalf, and that's definitely safer for him. It has some advantages and some disadvantages. One advantage that it has also is that if chametz is purchased after this meeting takes place, so I generally advise people to make the arrangements as close as possible to Pesach, because of that question. You want to first of all be able to describe as accurately as possible as what you have, but also if you purchase anything afterwards, so it's questionable whether that can be included or not. So if you sold your chametz to the rabbi, so for sure it cannot be included, because you can't sell stuff that you haven't bought yet. But if you're authorizing him, it's a little more feasible. It's still questionable. There's still a whole discussion whether or not you can authorize someone to sell something that you haven't bought yet. But at least it's got a possibility of working, and as far as why it should work. So that's, again, a reason why it's preferable. If the person who owns the chametz died after he made the arrangement before Pesach, so then that's problematic, because now he's not authorized anymore, because the new owner of the chametz are the Yorshim. So they would have to come do it again, and if they don't, if they're not able to take care of this in their moment of grief, they could end up losing whatever the chametz is if they don't take care of that. Again, you could ask a shayla if there's an honest involved in the life.
That's what that's passes down.
So they
would need to sell them.
So if it's before Pesach, right? If the owner of the chametz comes a week before Pesach and organizes the rabbi, and then the day before Pesach dies, so the day, 2 days before Pesach, let's say he dies, so now his children own all the chametz. So the rabbi is not authorized to sell it anymore because he has not been authorized by the owner of the chametz. So they could end up with a lot of chametz that no one is selling.
And the rabbi passes away.
If the rabbi passes away, so that's a problem. So another, definitely against the rabbi's passing away before Pesach. But so that, yeah, that presumably, some of the rabbis have, it's actually probably a good idea, have in their contracts that I authorize Rabbi so-and-so or whoever he authorizes, and sometimes they have assistant rabbis or other colleagues to do it on their behalf. If he only authorized this rabbi and the rabbi didn't give the authority to anyone else before he died, it's a question. Presumably nobody's going to do it. Presumably they have to scramble.
Don't we assume that's still the person, since we just made the rabbi the agent?
Yeah, so the question is there anything that's going to save them from this? Presumably not, except the possible onus had there afterwards. But presumably it's not being sold unless there's some alternate arrangements being made. Now, if the rabbi is sick and he sees this coming, he could theoretically tell his assistant to the light, you know, that you're empowered to do this also. But tell a colleague, otherwise it would tackle the problem. But so those are some of the issues associated with that. And we talked about a lot of other issues. Again, we're just quickly trying to contract the two things into 2 days into one. We talked a little bit about the commonly asked question of what happens if somebody finds in his house that they have a bottle of scotch or something in the closet they didn't know about. So there are those who would say, okay, destroy it because maybe it's not sold and it's a problem with Bali Rav Bali Matzeh. I would be noted to say the other way, that it's a problem with Gazela to destroy it, because the likelihood is that it is sold, and that the when we say on the forms that the chametz is located in such and such location, so it doesn't mean that I'm only selling the chametz that's in that location. The forms actually say I'm selling all the chametz I have, and it happens to list locations so that the person should know where to go to find the chametz. But really, the lashon is all the chametz is being sold. So therefore, if you find something that you didn't list, it's also still sold. So it's a problem with gzeila to destroy it, and I would not think that's a good idea, for reasons we'll get into more in a few minutes, to ever take the attitude, well, there's probably mochel and it's okay, and it seems like it's more likely a gzeila problem, and that's the attitude of Tzipi Sa Frank took also, that he says that even though the Gemara talks about what to do if you find chametz in your house on Pesach, so that was bizmanehem, but nowadays that everything is sold, so he would not recommend that. And there were those who objected, well, what about chametz gamer, if there's a minig not to sell chametz gamer? And others have, I think, correctly responded that that just means that l'chachila, you're not going to want to sell chametz gamer. But if you have chametz gamer, for sure you'd want it to be sold. Because why would you want to end up in ownership of chametz gamer? Definitely you'd want it to be sold. And in fact, that's why there are those who have a kpeda that even those who don't really believe in mechiras chametz should do mechiras chametz, that everyone should do mechiras chametz, because maybe there is something that he didn't find, and maybe there are chumras in because chametz that are not being fulfilled, and therefore, for sure, everyone should sell it. So that whole svara only makes sense if we're assuming that it will actually work on the chametz gomer. So for sure, that's the assumption. So even if it's absolute chametz that is found, so then that presumably would be in this category as well, that we should assume that it was sold and that it's not your property. Presumably, if you want to be machmir after Pesach, you get it back, and you want to choose to destroy it then, so then you're free of the gazela concern then. But if you destroy it before then, I think that would be an issue. Okay, I think it was Jonathan and Gil.
I heard Rav Schefter speak about one in terms of your chametz that's best going to be your chametz after the whole selling took place. So when you have the same problem with Rav Schefter and Pesach Frank here that you're also destroying.
So I think there the chametz that you're being mivar has already been set aside for the purposes of beer, and it's understood that sometimes it's spelled out to the purchaser that there's been that the chametz that's been set aside for burning, and that it's not technically right. Technically speaking, that it sounds like you're saying all the chametz I own. I think it's also made clear to the purchaser that this chametz that's being destroyed right now, it's not Now, there are other situations where you may have to make something clear. We mentioned, for example, if there are pesach chalios for Shabbos and you want to leave something out to use on Shabbos and then finish that or destroy it. We've discussed if you could destroy chametz on Shabbos, whether it's a zoreh or a tochein issue. And that is another situation where you may just say to the purchaser, listen, I'm leaving out these rolls, which I plan on eating the day before, and I have your permission to do so. And there are other scenarios that can come up where you explicitly have to point something out to the purchaser and get his permission.
So do we have to do that?
For our Pesach Shalos B'Shabbos? Yeah, presumably if that's what your plan is. If you're leaving out rolls that you own at the time, so then that would be the way to do it. There could be other ways, but that's just generally what's done. So then, what other issues do we talk about that? Hi?
So just what we were saying about that everybody should sell their chametz.
Yeah,
but
so that
would undo the whole thing in the Gemara of what you should do to chametz that you find.
Right, but that's the point. So in Echanami, so it does undo it, but
the Gemara
was before everyone had such an haga. It's not like there's a mitzvah to necessarily have that situation. But since the situation is now that it's sold, so then that just changes the mitzvahs. So then you're better off, maybe it's an extra safeguard to have it all sold. Another reason why there were those who wanted to sell the chametz regardless of where they kept anything is because of the question of kalim. So there are those who sell their kalim, there are others who argue very powerfully that that's a very bad idea because then you'll have to be total all the kalim that you buy back. So that's definitely not kedai. So then the question is, why would they want to sell the kalim in the first place? So because of the chametz that is balua in the kalim. So is that an issue? So many thought that it was not an issue, which is definitely an understandable position. While others thought that you could sell the chametz that is balua in the kalim, which is a difficult idea to really comprehend. This topic of debate between the Stipler and the Blyashiv, if that makes sense or not. But in that context also, so you have those who maintain that it's kedai to sell your chametz no matter what, just because of situations like that, that even if you're not keeping any identifiable products of chametz around the house, that there are other reasons to want to divest yourself of whatever chametz you have in this formal process. We also discussed that are mechiras chametz are generally done on the morning of the 14th on Erev Pesach, but there is often a mechira that's done the previous night on the evening of the or before the evening the afternoon of the 13th. So why is it done then? So it could be done then for two reasons. One is there are those who are machmir that if they're going to be away all of Pesach, so they may want to absolve themselves of B'dikas Chametz. So it's a good question whether, so you can get out of B'dikas Chametz if you lease out your whole house. So if you're not going to be home for the whole Pesach, so then you can do that, you can lease out your whole house and you're putter from B'dikas Chametz. So then the question is, do you have to do that leasing, which is part of the Mechira, do you have to do that before the Chi of B'dika starts? So then you'd be machmer to do that the afternoon of the 13th. Or, as many assume, should you say that, no, even if the Mechi of Bedikah started already, but you know you're not going to own this house over Pesach, then you're not going to be Mechi of to Bedikah. So that's many a maker like that, but there are those who do a Mechira earlier to avoid that question. But also, it's more pressing in relevance to somebody who's going to a different time zone. So if you're going to Eretz Yisrael, as is the common example, so then you're going to hit all the 6 or 7 hours earlier, depending on where the time zones are at the moment, or 10 hours earlier if you're coming from LA. So then that seriously shifts things. So then the question becomes, what is koveya for the chametz? Is it where the chametz is, or where the owner of the chametz is? So we generally are machmir, at least l'chachila, to assume it's where the owner of the chametz is. So therefore, if you're going to Eretz Yisrael, so then you'd have to have your chametz sold earlier because you're going to have the zman eser chametz much earlier than the sale that's taking place in America. We mentioned Rav Sternbach had a discussion where he thought maybe you could distinguish between the iser of owning chametz and the iser of chametz. that maybe the Isser of owning starts earlier, but the Isser of Hanah is based on where the Chametz is. So then that creates a split, which means the Chachirli should sell it earlier to avoid the Isser. But even if you don't, you still have time before the Isser of Hanah sets in to actually sell it. So that's another important consideration. And we also talked about some of the Diyud HaMalchus HaDina questions. We mentioned that there was a question that was raised that if we put in our contracts that we're selling all the liquors and the medicines, how can we do that? You're not allowed to sell either according to the law. So you can't sell liquor without a license, and you can't sell medicine without a license if you're not a pharmacist. So how can we allow that? So you mentioned, I think the question is better than the answer, because I'm not comfortable with the answer that, oh, well, the government knows this is just a ritual sale, so they don't care, because that's not the kind of approach you want to take to this whole issue. So I think the best answer you could have is that in terms of liquor, the taka probably aren't not good, because the liquor license is that you shouldn't open up a bar without a license. But presumably, if one individual has a bottle of wine that he doesn't want to finish and he wants to sell it to his neighbor on a one-time basis, probably the government taka doesn't mind that, so that's probably included here. The medicines is a much bigger issue, because that the government would be mocked even on a one-time basis, presumably. So then the best approach you can think of is that it's probably not mechuyav to sell the medicines to begin with, for the most part, so it's probably not as much of a serious issue. And also the question of dina malchus hadina, whether it invalidates the sale, that's a separate question as well. So the main point that we wanted to make, al pi derech ha-musar v'hashkafa, about this whole issue, and it's relevant to everything that we spoke about, and so why is it that Klal Yisrael has apparently largely landed on the side of supporting Mechiras Chametz, even in its expanded modern-day version, and not worried that it's a haram or that it's a game? And we wanted to suggest as follows, I feel is an important point, is that what is the Isser of owning Chametz on Pesach? What's the Isser of Bayura Bayim Matzeh? So according to the Ran, in the beginning of Pesachim, it's a Siag Ben HaTorah, that really it's, even though it's an Isser Daraisa, clearly, but it really is there to prevent us from eating Chametz on Pesach. So if that's the idea, that we're selling Chametz, we're getting rid of Chametz, so that we shouldn't come to eat it, so by selling it this way, even though it doesn't get removed from our house, and even though we know that it always ends up coming back to us after Pesach, and even though it may seem, therefore, like it's not having any lasting effect, it does accomplish one thing. It makes there an Isser of a little signal on the Chametz. It means that the Chametz is somebody else's property. So it creates a technical prohibition of stealing. So that's all we need, and we're making a statement that our kapeda, not to steal, is so strong that that will keep us from eating Chametz on Pesach, and that's as effective as not having the Chametz in the first place. So it's a statement of emphasis and belief in our financial integrity. And therefore, we could also suggest that we, a little bit alpi derech hadrosh, but hopefully it's meaningful, that we davka developed this practice at Pesach, the time we talk about Geula, we mentioned the smag, that the Geula can only happen when the Jews are well known for complete financial integrity, because otherwise, Sechel Hashem, how is God going to be able to redeem a nation that has a reputation for being dishonest? So therefore, it's important that we have the opposite reputation, so maybe we go out of our way to enter into a business dealing with Umma Sa'olam specifically now, and show how much we value the integrity of that relationship. And that will hopefully have such an effect that Klal Yisrael should be considered honest and full of integrity, so that there can be a full Geula. Okay, I think that was enough of what we said on that topic. Any questions about any of that? Any perspectives? Any attacks? Yes, sir.
I noticed my rabbi give a gift of money over to the person, who was going to be buying the chametz. Is that an issue of lo tachamim?
No. It's a complicated discussion, a little bit outside the scope of our chazara, but it's not a problem. Besides the fact that your rabbi knows very much what he's doing. But yes, go.
In terms of the kalim issue, so the ones who say that it's not an issue of that you don't have to call the kalim, so the reasons that I saw when I was reading about it is that everybody knows it's kind of a shady deal anyway, and they don't really give over the ownership, and it's still the Jew's house. So how doesn't that, like, pass?
I think it does. As I've maintained throughout, I'm very hesitant to rely on such stories at all. So I think all approaches like that should be avoided, and that we should take this as a very serious sale for all intents and purposes. And that carries through in all the approaches that we take here. Hi.
What's the actual violation if you take the Chametz, or if you throw it out, or if you steal it on Pesach?
I mean, which Pasuk Torah does it violate?
Yeah, it's Gedolah Goy.
Which may be it could be a Nesod Raisa. It's a little bit of Machlok Shoshonim, so it's either a Nesod Raisa or a Nesod Rabbana, but it's definitely something bad.
Right.
It's probably a Nesod Raisa. So, in any event, and on top of that, so here, especially in this context, it also undermines the whole, makes the whole thing now back into Harama territory, and if you don't take it seriously yourself, then you shouldn't. It's also a Pesach issue. It's a Choshen Mishpat issue and an Aruch Chaim issue. If you don't take the Choshen Mishpat seriously, then it's not going to work for your Aruch Chaim either. Gil had suggested, we talked about this the first time, maybe we should say that people who aren't Makbin on Gzeil in general shouldn't be allowed to sell the Chametz for this reason. So it basically shows the interconnectedness of these two areas of Halacha for this purpose. Okay, so that's, I think, enough of what we said about that topic. So any questions about that? So those are basically our yontif topics, in addition to Sfiras Omer that we spoke about recently, so we're not going to cause the recent stuff. So we have maybe a few minutes left, so what I'll just try to do is I'll try to start the Tofein electricity topic now. We'll probably have to continue it a little bit into tomorrow. So I guess we said tomorrow will be 11 o'clock. But just to basically lay out some of the basic issues in the few minutes that we have, is there is a major discussion. We'll discuss two points at once now. We talked about both electricity and refuah as subsets of tochen. We both came out of perhaps a tangent, let's say, of the tochen issue. And another saha shabbat between electricity and refuah is if you want to talk about electricity on Shabbos, or if you want to talk about refuah on Shabbos, so those topics could mean, both of them could mean two opposite things. So in the case of electricity on Shabbos, if I give a shiur titled electricity on Shabbos, it could refer to two opposite things. It could refer to my doing actions that are otherwise mutter on Shabbos, but I'm using electricity to do them, and maybe electricity is a chilul Shabbos. So that's one topic. We didn't talk about that at all. We're not going to cause that because that was a topic we didn't talk about. The other thing it could mean is, what if you're doing something that should be asur on Shabbos? It's the malacha by itself. It's one of the 39 malachas. But instead of doing it directly, you are using electric power to bring it about, using an electric appliance. So that was what we did talk about. Should we say that should be better? First topic that we didn't talk about takes a mutter action and possibly makes it usr. This topic is there an usr action that becomes mutter or less of an isser because you're doing it through electricity? Basically the opposite topic. So to discuss that, we noted that this seems to draw heavily on an earlier machlokas between the Magen Avraham and the Eben HaOzer primarily. And many Achronim line up on both sides, but they're the famous disputants in this issue. And we talked about this also in the context of a few other malachas as well. Came up a couple of times. This is one of the major machlokas in Hilchos Shabbos. So essentially the issue is, if you want to use a water mill, you have a water mill that's going to operate on Shabbos because the water is going to make it move by itself. So in the pre-electric era, that would be how you would have such a thing. So if you want to place some substance into the water mill, and then on Shabbos it's going to grind it up through its water coming later and turning it and making it happen, so is that a malacha if you're doing it indirectly? So the Mishnah talks about this, but the Mishnah talks about you're placing it there before Shabbos. So the Mishnah says not to place the stuff in a windmill before Shabbos for it to be ground up on Shabbos. And There is the machlokus in the Gemara of what the issue is. It's either an issue of hashmas kol, if you have a malacha happening on Shabbos, even if you're not doing it, but it sounds bad, it looks bad, it gives the appearance of zozel Shabbos. So that was one issue. Or maybe it's an issue of shvisas kelim. That Beis Shammai's view, that maybe not only are we supposed to abstain from malacha, but your utensils should also not do malacha. So either possibility is kind of a lesser madrega, because shvisas kelim we don't actually paskin like. So if it's an issue of shvisas kelim, it won't be a problem really at all. And if it's an issue of hashmas kol, so that's an issue to Rabbanan and subject to a lot of other discussions. That's not an issue to the rest. So putting it there before Shabbos is either a problem according to a view we don't follow, or a problem with Rabbanan. And there's enough locus for showing them how to paskin on which issue it was. But what we're interested in here now is, what if you do it on Shabbos? If you put this in the mill on Shabbos, and then your hope is that the water will now come later and grind it up, is that usher on Shabbos itself, at least on a level of Minhag Torah? So the Magen Avraham thought that it was not. Magen Avraham thought that this is not your direct action, and therefore this is not considered to be the malacha. You're not doing the malacha. The water and the windmill are doing the malacha. And the Avin Ozer disagreed. And the Avin Ozer said that you are chayiv min haTorah. This is an issa min haTorah. This is a violation of Shabbos. And one of the things that was at issue was the Gemara about Zoreh. That's why we talked about it earlier, both in earlier in the Chazara and earlier in the semester, because the Gemara asks in Bava Kamma and Daf Samach, why is it that you're chayav for Zoreh? If you are going to use the wind to do your work for you, if it's spreading a fire, in the context of the Zikin, so it might be your putter for that, and yet the Malach of Zoreh involves throwing stuff up into the air and having the wind blow it away. So why is it that you're chayav for that? That's a malacha. If it's similar to using the wind to blow your fire around, that you could be putter for. So after going back and forth, the Gemara has an answer, malachas machshavas. And we saw in that context that it was a machlokus how to understand what malachas machshavas means. It doesn't mean that Zoreh is an exception, and because it was in the Mishkan, so it's a malacha that way, that's how it was done, but anything else, taka, you would be putter. Or is this a sweeping Shabbos statement? It means that Shabbos is unique. And because of Malachas Machshavas, if your indirect plan gets carried out, you are chayiv anyway. So the Magen Avraham is understanding it as Zoreh is the exception, and therefore for Tochen it doesn't apply if you use the watermill. And the Avin Ozer is understanding it as a statement about Shabbos as a whole, that Shabbos is Malachas Machshavas. If your plan gets carried out, you are going to be chayiv. And we saw that really the Avin Ozer is telling you a couple of kedushim. He's telling you if you have a malacha done indirectly, you're going to be chayiv for it. He's telling you that if it is a time delay, you're going to be chayiv for it. All of these are kedushim. And it's also possible to say that he's just extending the Zohar point to saying any malacha that's the derech of doing it, that could be a chiyuv d'oraisa. And now when it comes to the watermill exists because that's the derech of doing it, and you're going to be chayiv for it. The Magen Avraham's position, that in general you're not chayiv for this, so that could possibly be supported, as Rav Shlomo Zalman points out, by the general attitude that we have in Hilchos Shabbos, that we talked about extensively in the first semester, that Shabbos requires you to actually do something, and we're more concerned about you are doing something than we are about the result. So maybe even if this brings about the result, but you're not actually doing it, so maybe that's why the Magen Avraham would maintain that you are a putter. You mentioned that Rav Zipei Seth Frank points out that he thinks even within the Magen Avraham that this is all premised in the fact that there's a time delay here, but if this would happen immediately, if this would immediately result in something being ground up, he thinks everyone would agree that that is subject to a discussion whether that's true or not. How we also mentioned, so basically this machlokus is very relevant to the whole electricity model. So if you have another co-op doing something, so is that comparable to the water activating this water mill. So if you're going to set a timer, let's say, or have some type of, even if you push a button, but it takes some time for something to happen, so is that going to be considered direct action, or is that considered to be indirect? So it's very likely relevant to this whole debate. This debate seems to be the core issue. We mentioned that the Evna Ozer has a proof against the Magen Avraham, which is problematic. The Magen Avraham agrees with this also, that the proof is from the Aluka, is from a leech. That the Evna Ozer says if somebody puts a leech on himself in order to draw out blood, so he wants to do an act of Chavala, but he has this leech doing it, so then that's going to be Malacha. And the problem is the Magen Avraham also agrees with that. So you have to figure out how to distinguish between the leech case and the watermill case, according to the Magen Avraham. So Rav Shlomo Zalman had a very subtle distinction that in the case of the watermill, the malacha is happening regardless. You're just adding another victim into the malacha, but the watermill is going anyway. But in the case of the leech wouldn't be drawing any blood unless you provoked it to, so you are the source of the whole malacha. So therefore, maybe that's why the Magen Avraham was more ready to acknowledge that that would be a problem. And then that was actually most of that issue. We discussed a couple of nuances that some, Begley Kal and others, suggest that even if you're chayav for this windmill, that's only that which goes around the first time, but the second time already is a new chalav. So they would agree that you're putter for that. We mentioned also that the Vital and the Bir Halacha also point out that if the grain is already there and you open the door to the windmill to get it moving around, so that would be more of a direct maisa that even the Magen Avraham would probably think you are chayav for. And we mentioned also that the Tiferes Yisrael felt that in the case of a windmill, let's say, where the wind is a little bit less reliable than the water, that thinks you would be pater because of a hasra suffix situation, that you can never be sure that it's actually going to happen. And the Bir Halacha maintained that even though you can't be sure how much wind is going to come, since the shear is so small for tofen, you're likely going to violate the shear anyway, so he doesn't think there would necessarily be a hasra suffix issue attached to that. I think that was most of what we said about that topic. Any questions about that? Any other issues about that? Okay, so maybe we should stop there instead of trying to start a new topic. So what do we have left for tomorrow and the next day? So at least we want a chazer refuah. That was a major thing after this. And lush. And shnayim shaso. So we'll try to get those in over the next 2 days. And that will be all the stuff that we didn't do recently. So anything else that we don't get to is stuff that we at least did recently, so it's less necessary for Chazara. Any questions about that?
Is it possible we can get a list of topics so that we can prepare all the
stuff? Yes. So can we do that?